Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
The Brad Pitt eating thing. What is this? What is this thing? I don't understand this.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Aaron Dicer.
You're not wearing your ring.
I sold it. I don't have a husband, or didn't you get the papers?
My last day inside.
I told you I'd write.
Hello, everybody. It is, look at that. Look at Aaron coming correct with the fingers there, the peace sign or whatever. Hello, everybody. It's welcome to Recotopia episode 117. Today's big recommend is Ocean's 11 from 2001. I'm Chris Atkinson, joined by a Las Vegas current resident, I guess. No, you can't call him a resident, but current visitor of Vegas, Aaron Dicer. How you doing?
Heidely ho, Sin City Arenos.
Yes, yes. I don't know if there is a proper Vegas greeting that you could possibly come up with, but I'm glad that you're still consistent with the Flanderino there.
Mm-hmm.
Also, welcome to watching us talk about movies today. Chat, you coming out here and watching us on a Tuesday after Memorial Day. All right. So, Aaron, do you have any small recommends?
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living expense.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
I do. Let's just get this one right out of the way. Just came out. Furiosa, Mad Max Saga. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about it. I think we've both seen it. I loved it. I am a little bit different than most in that I don't have the, I really like Fury Road, but it was never like this amazing thing that I, you know, put at the top of all my lists. And I was just like, oh, George Miller really knows how to shoot action. And, you know, I'm glad this universe is coming back. I think Furiosa is better than Fury Road. I think it structurally works better for me. I think that it is almost a little more honest about its main character. Fury Road was really kind of about Furiosa as well, but it was kind of couched as a, you know, being about Mad Max. This is, pure Furiosa. This is Furiosa for this one. And I enjoyed it all the way through. There are mind-blowing set pieces. Is it safe to say that George Miller just knows how to direct big scale action better than anybody else right now? Like, it's just, he blows me away with this stuff.
He probably does. I guess it's a different kind of action, but the John Wick movies are all about this practical effects and real stunt people and things like that. And I don't know, as far as like, you know, out there in the environment somewhere I don't know if anybody else does it, because everybody else is doing the big CGI stuff. So a lot of this stuff is just, you know, we'll just have a computer come up with it later. And this one is definitely not that. You can tell just by the camera work, and it's just so refreshing to see that. There's a scene in here that blew my mind where he just basically conducts an entire action scene all in one shot. And it's just a beautifully made thing. I am going to need some time with this. I agree with you on the structure of the movie. I think it is better than Fury Road when it comes to that. I don't know if it's better than it action wise. And I am not sure that they give you, they give you all the good motivations of Furiosa and what she does and why she does it. But I, there's a gap here, I feel like, in this movie where I'm like, man, I could have maybe used more Chris Hemsworth as the main villain of this movie for a while instead of him, because he kind of disappears for a little bit. But anyway, not to get into spoilers and anything like that. I really liked it, too. I'm not sure if I like it as much as Fury Road, but there are some majorly great things in this. So I was happy with it.
And I think maybe a lot of your enjoyment of this movie when you watch it may come down to how you feel about the ending, because there are some choices made with where this movie ultimately goes. And I don't necessarily mean story-wise, narrative-wise. I mean tone-wise. Like, there's an interesting kind of gear shifting that's happening through the end of this movie that I really loved. There's an intimacy to it that I have found missing in a lot of modern action movies that I really loved.
Yeah.
But I know others who hate the ending of this movie. Like, I think a lot of it might come down to that for people as they watch it.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, like you said, he's, I think when he's directing these action scenes, he really does sort of just like, well, this was here and it's going to be there in the next scene. And if this something, if somebody's about to fall off the back of this rig, we're going to show him falling off the back of the rig. Like, everything is in place on these things. A lot of times you watch action scenes, you're like, oh, he fell off the thing, but then there's no like follow through to it. That's what I was sitting there thinking on one of these action scenes, and somebody gets thrown off or something like that of the rig. And I was like, okay, usually they cut, and then you're just like, oh, well, out of sight, out of mind, but not in this movie.
Nope.
He gets away, and the guy's just like, he's tumbling off and everything. So he keeps track of everything. Everything's continuous in it. And, well done. So.
Yeah, it's so good.
A much smaller scale action movie from the 60s. I bought a whole bunch of Criterion Collection stuff a month or two ago, and it's going to take the rest of my life to get through it probably, but I bought a whole box set of this character named Zatoichi, and the first movie is The Tale of Zatoichi, and it's a blind swordsman movie. The blind swordsman goes into a town, and it's basically run by gangsters. And I guess I'm ignorant on the Yakuza, but this is like way back in the day. They're talking about Yakuza. So I guess this has always been a thing, Yakuza gangsters and stuff like that. But, he goes into this town and, your main guy said that I could come out here and hang out if I wanted to. And they're like, yeah, cool. And so he's just one of these characters. He's not to be taken lightly, but I got in this movie almost immediately because one of the very first scenes is him doing a gambling game with dice in a can, and all these people around him know he's blind. And like the first one he does, he accidentally lets the dice go out of the can, and he's like, okay, was this odds or evens? And everybody's like, says it's even, then like betting on even. He's like, so everybody's betting on even? And they're like, yes. And there's like, and then they find out that, oh, it's even because they can see the dice. And then on the next roll, he does the same thing, and everybody's betting on odds. It's like, oh, so everybody's betting on odds. And so he goes down and he feels around and he feels the dice. He's like, oh, those dice must have fallen out of my sleeve. And he pulls the can up and the dice are like even. And so everybody's like, you cheated us. He's like, wait a minute. So you made the bet based on what you could see, and you're telling me that I cheated you? He's in this town, and like people know of his prowess and everything. And the main gangster guy's like, yeah, you should do some tricks for us. And he's like, my skills are not for that type of thing. I don't do that. I don't do it. Meanwhile, there's another town with another gangster who's got another swordsman at his place. And this guy is like a world-class samurai guy. And there's this building up tension between the two sides. And of course, the one gangster guy wants his blind swordsman to come in and help him. And the other guy wants this world-class samurai guy to help him. And so it's sort of building to this whole thing. Of course, before we even get to this this fight, the blind swordsman and this other samurai guy meet each other a couple of times, not knowing who they are, or where they are, or anything like that. They meet them out there, meet each other out there just to fish. And they develop this relationship that's very interesting before we even get to the part where they might even fight each other by the end of it. And the samurai guy is like, he's like a drunk. He's definitely on the verge of death. He's got consumption. And one of his things, when he finds out who Zatoichi is, he says, you know, I've always wanted to fight you. Of course he did. Of course he does. He's always wanted to fight him and everything. So of course we're building towards that point. And the movie is very good. It's a brisk movie. They made like, I think 30 of these and a TV series and all sorts of stuff. That's how popular this character was. So,
yeah. I checked this out cause, I saw you were going to talk about it, and as I'm watching it and, or looking for it, actually, I'm like, there are like 26 of these things. I was like, you know, we think the Fast franchise has a lot of movies. You know, it's quite a franchise. And after watching the movie, I totally see why. I agree with everything you said. Zatoichi is one of the coolest movie characters I've ever seen. He's just great. I love everything about him. I love his physical presence. I love his sense of humor. Very subtle. I love his ability to know when it's time to blow everybody's mind and when it's time to lay back. He's such a fun character that he makes the movie for me. I'm not sure without that character, like I think there are times in this movie where my mind's wandering a little bit and that kind of stuff. But man, when he's on his game and splitting candle wicks in half, I'm like totally there. So, yeah, exactly. This movie was fun. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Absolutely.
All right. So for my next one, I'm going to go with a movie I just saw recently, still in theaters, called I Saw the TV Glow.
Oh, I've seen trailers for this.
This is a very interesting movie. I wouldn't call this like, you know, the classic Rekka Warn kind of thing, because I'm not really warning. What I would say is this is a fantastic movie that just isn't built for me totally, but I'm in awe of some of the things that it's doing. It's very David Lynchian. Maybe that'll help kind of clarify what I'm saying. David Lynch has this way of creating atmosphere and tone and, you know, strangeness and curiosity and weirdness that is very much present in this movie. It just doesn't always work for me, but it's so beautiful, so artistic. And the movie itself primarily works as a metaphor. There's not a lot narratively to really hang your hat on in this movie, but as a metaphor for the idea of identity, how it relates to media, specifically in this case, trans identity, and how it relates to media, and how it relates to whether you bury that or accept that, those kind of things. It's really, really meaningful and powerful. And so I did want to give it a small recommend, even though it's not my kind of movie. And but it is really, really powerful. And I'm glad I watched it. I like more of a narrative story. I'm a story guy. I like a good metaphor, but usually when it's working in conjunction with a great, you know, story. And this is pretty much, for me, at least from my interpretation, a metaphor movie. And as that, it works brilliantly. It really does.
Yeah, the trailers for this look very interesting. I have nothing other to add other than that. It's something like, hey, I'll definitely watch that when I get a chance to see it. But that's all I'm at. There's an image of someone like with their head stuck in the TV as people walk by and everything. I was like, okay, you got me. That image right there alone makes me want to see this movie.
Uh huh. Yeah.
So anyway. My other movie today is basically inspired by the fact that we did History of Violence a couple of weeks ago, and I started thinking about other David Cronenberg movies, and I've seen this one a few times, but I wanted to get it or give it a rewatch, and that's Videodrome. From 1983. Speaking of
sticking your head in a television.
There you go. Exactly. This is one of those movies that at the end of it, you're going to probably go, huh, what's going on here? I don't know exactly what I just saw. But if, you know, like, I feel like the movie Strange Days owes a lot to this movie because James Woods plays this guy who's the head of some sort of like, I don't know, a cable access television station. And he is looking for the best in like snuff film type stuff, but they've got to be like produced, right? They can't be like, they're not real snuff films he's looking for here. But he's buying stuff from people who've got the, like the best in, you know, in sexual, you know, like movies that are just about sex and movies that are just torture and stuff like that. They're very, very produced. And obviously there's a little bit enough to fake it to where you're like, okay, they're not really doing this. But he's also got this guy on his employ who's trying to find these secret signals out in the wild. And one of these secret signals seems to be finding this, where people are going into this room and they're getting tortured for an hour straight. And they're like, how? And James Woods is like, why would you be a part of a show like this? Why would you do this? What are you hoping for to accomplish with a show like this? He gets very curious about the show that he's watching. He wants to know who's behind it. He wants to try to figure out how to get it on his TV station, because he thinks this is the next big thing and that people are going to want to watch this a lot. So he starts watching it. There's a point where he gets on a talk show, and there's a character on there played by Debbie Harry, Blondie, who's there to be the sort of the counterpoint to what James Woods does, but turns out that she really does like all the stuff. She does like watching sex and watching violence and all that. And before you know it, they're like on a date where basically they're at his house, and they're like, and she's like, I'll watch anything that you've got here. I don't care. This is my jam here. I like seeing sex and violence and everything. So, after a while, once he starts investigating this TV signal enough, he starts hallucinating a little bit. And because he's hallucinating, and because it's a David Cronenberg movie, he's hallucinating a lot of things, like video cassettes that breathe and TVs that breathe. And he's got a video cassette hole in his chest that he can put videotapes into, and a gun that turns all flesh and everything when he's going around. And so he's really trying to get to the bottom of all of this. And it's a lot of weirdness and a lot of Cronenbergian weirdness going on in this movie. You never really quite know what's going on. Although Cronenberg has said up to a certain point, you know that everything happened. And then after this other point, you don't, like, he's not telling what's happening. Anyway, this movie, if you have suicidal trigger warnings, there's one of the most famous suicidal scenes ever at the end of this movie. That's not really a spoiler, because you don't even know what the hell's going on by the time this gets to the end. But this is such a fascinating, interesting movie that I've seen four or five times, and I still couldn't tell you exactly what is real and what's not. And I think that's the point, because this movie's really talking about us watching stuff that is real, or watching stuff that we believe is real, and making our own reality out of it. And as some people point out, it's a very prescient movie, considering what we watch and consume on the internet and everything, and like what we have made into our own reality and everything.
Yeah. It's really, really interested in the connection of sex and violence. No more evident than the gun turning into a very phallic, fleshy, you know, attached appendage. And the VCR slot becoming very fleshy and similar to other fleshy things. Yeah, it's clear Cronenberg and Freud would have been like best friends. There's a lot of weird stuff. And like you said, it's very prescient about where media has gone, where technology has gone, and about how we continue to process what does creating art, viewing art, about the darker parts of life or the more hidden parts, even we should say, of life. How does that impact us? All of those kind of things. We're asking those questions because it's more available than ever. So yeah, it's a very interesting and not my cup of tea, but
I was about to say, this doesn't sound like a movie you enjoy.
No, but I can respect the attempt at, you know, the discussion, and the themes in this are clear, and I always dig that. So
yeah, absolutely. All right. Now we're going to get on to our big recommend, which is Ocean's 11 from 2001. And since this is Aaron's, take it away, Aaron.
Hi, podcast listeners. Danae here, and I want to tell you about Mint Mobile because they saved me money, and I appreciate that. Mint Mobile also made it easy to save money on my phone plan. So here's how it works. Here's how to get great wireless for $15 a month with the purchase of their 3-month plan. You go to mintmobile.com/recotopia, and you're going to see all of their plans. And right now, all of the 3-month plans are just $15 a month, and that includes the unlimited plan. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan, and you can bring your number along with all of your existing contacts. And that's it. That's how easy it is. Just you go and you look at the information, you're like, yeah, that doesn't seem so bad, does it? The hardest part is just deciding to break up with your current phone people. To get this new customer offer and your 3-month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. That is mintmobile.com/recotopia, and cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/recotopia. Heads up, $45 upfront payment is required. That's equivalent to the $15 a month, and new customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business and sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
All right. Ocean's 11 is both the incorrect number of existing oceans and a 2001 Steven Soderbergh film that, despite being released in December, somehow was nominated for 0 Academy Awards. We begin at a parole hearing for Danny Ocean. A character as calm, cool, and collected as the Clooney who plays him. We get an inkling that Ocean is a career criminal, but with a slick smile, he finds himself free to hit up Atlantic City, maybe throw some quarters around at a blackjack table with a new dealer, definitely named Ramon and definitely not Frank. A coded message then sends Clooney to Caesars to read some newspaper exposition about who will become the big bad and get some info from that dealer, who all of a sudden is actually named Frank, even though he looks a lot more like a Mac to me. Cut to Rusty, who is currently chewing on some nachos while waiting for discount Toby Maguire, who's playing a fictional character named Topher Grace. Rusty is there to teach some actors how to play poker because apparently their idea of fun is to pull a Warren Beatty and bet everything on reds. After likely explaining that even if all reds was a poker hand, you still probably don't open shove with all reds jack high. Rusty drowns his sorrows in a drink at the bar and while watching some fully clothed window dancers. And then he heads back in to see that the game has been joined by the string betting Danny Ocean. He's there to check in with his old buddy to see if he wants to knock off a casino with him for old time's sake. After indicating the team may need some Hall of Fame boxers, football players, and singers, they agree to go see Ruben, who, by the way, is not Ruben K, the poker player from Omaha who invented the sandwich. Or is he?
Ooh,
whoever he is, he regales the fellas with why it could never work by watch mojoing them a list of the top three attempted casino heists. After the boys play disinterested, Ruben plays interested, and when he finds out the common enemy is the captain of the Avalon from Passengers, he gets super psyched to bankroll the whole endeavor. Cut to a putting the team together montage where we lock in Frank, meet the Malloy brothers, the tech guy Livingston, and the munitions expert Basher, who's on to new things after helping out Chan and Tucker in Rush Hour 2. They also go catch a Barnum show where they meet the acrobatic Yen, and then to a dog track where they hit up the cantankerous Saul. Then after remembering the movie isn't called Ocean's 10, they head to Chicago for one last team member. It's an easy get, considering the guy they're after will appear in just about anything for a few minutes if you just ask.
Yeah,
now
true.
That the team is complete, we get a lot of sphereless Vegas drone porn, so we are 100% sure that we're in Las Vegas pre-2022. And it's time for the first meeting. With an in-depth PowerPoint, Ocean lays out all the obstacles involved and then drops a $150 million carrot in front of them to fully set the movie's stakes. Then it's quickly on to the recon, a plan to kill the electricity, and a plan to hack into the system involving some strategically placed balloons and the key card of a security guard who also apparently enjoys watching fully clothed dancers. The fifth task is construction, which is quickly moved past for movie reasons, so we can focus on transportation and Bernie Mac literally strong-arming a car salesman into a good deal. Saul's then getting fitted for Lyman Zerga's suit, and Matt Damon gives Rusty the rundown on Benedict's schedule while Rusty snarfs some shrimp and subsequently realizes that Benedict's girl is a Julia Roberts impersonator named Tess, who also just happens to be Danny Ocean's ex. Rusty reminds Danny that Tess is not equally divisible by 11, and Ocean assures him it's going to be okay. Benedict meets Zerga, and Ocean meets up with Tess to flash some riz and chatter up about Vermeer's later decline. With some of the best tete-a-tete dialogue in movie history, we get a sense for the explosive chemistry between the two and the divide that Danny has to clear to be in her good graces again. Benedict finally interrupts them and, after some subtle posturing, offers Danny some free towels. Soderbergh pulls a Hitchcock by strangers on a training some faces at a casino demolition, and we finally get to the amazing Yen's demonstration. But not all of it, for movie reasons. But also because Basher realizes that the demolition has revealed some issues. Once they translate his Cockney rhyming slang, Basher suggests a pinch could do the trick. But they need to rob one from a science center. And now Soderbergh pulls a Nolan by staging a heist within a heist. Of course, we don't really get much of the heisting. Mostly it's just a plot obstacle of Linus disobeying and Butterfly affecting his way into smashing Yen's hand. Then another obstacle appears, and this time it's Ocean, who's gotten himself banned from the casino. So Rusty kicks him out of the band and brings in Jason Bourne to sing lead, and it's on to the heist. Saul kicks things off by bringing a briefcase in to store in a vault, even though he's almost waylaid by Bucky Buchanan from Saratoga doing his best impersonation of Needle Nose Ned from Case Western High. Up next, the Malloys wheel in some yummy Yen room service, and Caldwell pretends to be the NGC and gets Ramon kicked out so Danny could have a few more minutes with Tess and probably other heist-related reasons. Bernie Mac then plays the race card so Linus can pickpocket Benedict, which is a dead giveaway that Ocean was never supposed to do this part. Speaking of, Ocean is now taking a premature faux beating in a cameraless room, and Saul, not feeling so good, man, is on the verge of collapse. We then get a glimpse of the fight crowd, but Cage and Sinise are nowhere to be seen, so the movie isn't all that interested in staying there. Back upstairs, down goes Reiner, which gives Livingston just enough time to switch the elevator feed so Matt and George can go out to the coast and have a few laughs in the elevator shaft. Meanwhile, the Malloys, who look strikingly like the balloon delivery guy, the Russian security guys, and the room service crew, come in to revive Saul with Brad Pitt, who somehow is not eating anything in this scene when he pronounces Saul dead. Basher is given the go-ahead to kill the power and EMPs the entire strip just long enough for Clooney and Damon to descend down the elevator and all bedlam to break loose in both the ring and at the tables. The boys then find their way to the other side of the casino door, and Yin signifies that it's go time. But oh no, he's stuck. Thankfully, the trigger conveniently is out of battery power just long enough for Yin to get out of the way. As the cameras show the crew loading the money, Rusty places a call to Pretty Woman's pocket and asks for Benedict so that he can spill the beans on the robbery. This rushes Benedict to security to see the monitors, that seem to show normal vaults are actually being robbed. Rusty lays out the deal that if Benedict lets them take $80 million out the door, they won't blow up the other $80 million. Benedict calls 911 and then tells Rusty to give him the lowdown on how this is all going to work. So let me explain it. No, there's too much. Let me sum up. Guards load money in truck, air stuff go boom. As SWAT pulls up, Benedict tells Rusty to run and hide, but Rusty is way ahead of him. Benedict is following the van and watching SWAT invade the vault. Once Benedict takes a look at the mess, he tells SWAT to get lost and then needs to know what's happening with the van. They tell Benedict that the van wasn't carrying money. Pause for effect. They tell Benedict that the van wasn't carrying money and they just blew up worthless flyers, which honestly is probably not a very nice thing to say because I'm sure Sherry put a lot of work into those flyers and deserves to have her work respected.
I think she did.
Work is real work. Terry starts putting two and two and one together and realizes that the vault on tape was a phony and that the real money was taken by the SWAT team, led by a Rusty who reveals himself to the audience and also the cameras in the casino that he is still walking through. But Danny isn't done as he and Tess tune into tonight's episode of Candid Camera, where Alan Funt has Andy Garcia say he'd prefer his $160 million over her. As Claire de Lune swells, Tess chases down a handcuff. Danny gives him a kiss, and we see the rest of the crew enjoy the Bellagio fountains in a lineup that could only be staged because people line up four deep for every stinking show of that fountain.
That's what I'm saying.
One by one, their very rich silhouettes walk away until only Saul remains. And as the strings fade, the only thing left to be stolen is this movie's perfect ending, as an unnecessary coda breaks the mood with a terrible Ted Nugent joke. All that's left now is for Danny, Tess, and Rusty to drive off into a future of three Ocean sequels and a 60s-style remake using the AI likeness of Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., and Dean Martin. And that is Ocean's 11. Chris, what'd you think this time through?
I've always enjoyed this movie. It's better than the other two, which top so much more ridiculousness on top of everything. And this movie is definitely ridiculous and still impossible. I don't care how many times, you tell me that this is, you get 11 best people in the world to try to do this. You're going to fail. I'm sorry. You're going to fail doing this, but I've always enjoyed it. It's not that type of movie where you're sitting there like deconstructing everything. I do think that the flyers is the biggest plot hole of that entire heist because they have to get the flyers down there somehow. And who's brought the flyers down there? Nobody, but they're there. They're there to do the thing at the end. Going through this, I don't have very many things to say about this, but I love the Soderbergh opening with Clooney walking into the parole hearing and it's just on him the whole time. No edits. Until the very end where they get on the little close-up of him. And I think Viola Davis, that's her voice over the one of the parole hearing people. I believe that's right.
Makes sense because Soderbergh used her a lot. Like he really liked Viola.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
I do love that opening. It's very, very Soderbergh and especially follows, especially with like Aaron Brockovich and stuff like that, that he had just done, has that same kind of feel, out of sight for sure. Yes. The Brad Pitt eating thing. What is this? What is this thing? I don't understand this. Why does every actor of his stature have a thing like this? Where is that in the contract or is it just incidental? because Tom Hanks has a peeing thing. He has peeing in his movies.
Should see a doctor about that.
Right, he should. I mean, you know, obviously Green Mile was the crescendo of the peeing. I don't know if I want to go there, but Brad Pitt, every movie, it's popping something in his mouth, man. Mm-hmm. What is the deal?
Oh, and it's the worst of this movie. I like every scene. It's amazing.
I love this is something. I don't know if they had to have meant to do this. This is right after they're teaching all the young stars of the time, Topher Grace and Chad Michael Murray and all these guys, Joshua Jackson, the poker. They walk out of the club and everybody starts clamoring towards Topher Grace and everything like that. And nobody cares about Brad Pitt and George Clooney. So I love the meta hilarity of Brad Pitt mm-hmm. and George Clooney, obviously not playing themselves, walking out of a club and no one cares, but they're all mad for Topher Grace and all these other people come out. I love how they have just this normal conversation after they walk in front of all that madness and then just sitting there like, yeah, we're just a couple of normal guys. Nobody cares who we are. I love how Rusty and Danny go into the meeting with Ruben knowing that their pitch is terrible and won't work, but they're playing this great con knowing that Ruben will eventually ask which casinos they plan to knock off and knowing it's his biggest enemy that runs them. And that's how they're going to hook him. They know that they're not going to be able to hook him just by saying, hey, we're going to rob Terry Benedict's, you know, casinos. We're going to, tell you this plan we have to rob the casinos. You're going to say no. And then at the end, you're going to be excited because of who is involved with it. So I love that little con that they play on them. We have sinned this movie before. I was not on the script and I don't remember everything that was in the script for Ocean's 11, but I do think it's funny that it's weird that Rusty says that there's a potential issue with the availability for Basher. And we cut to Basher stealing, like robbing a bank.
As if he knows he's robbing a bank right at this very moment, and he somehow gets there. That's so weird.
like either you know about the robbery in progress and you know that it's going to go bad and you're going to be there to bail him out, or it's just a movie storytelling technique.
There's a simple fix too, which is just to change the verb tense. There were some issues with his availability, and then it happened in the past. You already got him or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I guess maybe there may be some issues with his availability because maybe he'll get caught for this thing that he, was already doing and I, snuck him out of. So technically he's a wanted man. I don't know. You're right. I had the same thoughts. I was like, I don't understand this.
I was puzzling over that for quite a bit. And they've got 2 weeks, 2 weeks to prepare for this job. Any information that they gather, by the way, during this whole thing could be completely out of date by the time they have to rob this casino. Like the certain employees may not be there at the time that they do this. There might be, and sure, I think that we're supposed to believe that they know everything about this, meaning they know like the everybody's schedules and everything. So like if there is a situation that comes up with different employees or whatever, they'll have an answer for that. But they're like going deep on all these employees and everything and like how everything goes. And they got 2 weeks. They get this done in 2 weeks, not to mention, as you alluded to, building an entire replica of the vault that they have to, use in this thing as well. I think that's hilarious. Now, yes, you did mention one of my favorite parts of this movie. The tete-a-tete with Danny and Tess is great. The dialogue is really, really well done in this. And everything that they say has a thing that comes back to them every single time. So, the anchor of that one is, does he make you laugh? And she goes, well, he doesn't make me cry. Mm. And that's devastating. And then there's so many other things that happen in there where it's just like, they'll say something and then they'll come back. Like it's the whole thing, like, where you're, So you don't lie anymore. No, he's like, I don't do that anymore. What, lie? Or no, what, steal? And he goes, no, why? Or something like that. So this is like this. I love that back and forth between them so much. It's very well done. Absolutely a fantastic part. Then, you mentioned the demolition scene borrowing from Strangers on a Train. That is a great shot of everybody turning their heads to see the demolition while Matt Damon and George Clooney just look straight forward. Mm-hmm. I do like this dynamic between Casey Affleck and Scott Kahn. I don't think they're professional at all, and I don't know if you would really hire these guys for anything. They obviously do the roles that they're supposed to do in this thing. They're supposed to be this type of very low level thing, but what I do like is, even though they're not professional on the outside of the job, when it comes to the job, they're extremely professional, and they can even use that dynamic they can use it to help out in the overall, like, they always argue. So like the whole thing with the balloons is them just being themselves, essentially. So they can still do that, but like, it's kind of crazy to think that, would you hire these guys? And I probably wouldn't. There's probably no way I would hire these people, but they end up being very professional during the job. The only time they're not is when they're in the van and they're trying to get the pinch thing, which I think that whole scene is the movie trying to make it look like, oh, well, it's not that easy, because Matt Damon inexplicably is on the van, even though they don't need him. I don't know why they even brought him along if they never intended to put him in there. So the only reason Matt Damon is on this van is to get annoyed at the brothers and yelling at each other, and then get off the van and go in as they're pulling the pinch in, and he gets trapped in the building and everything. So that's, to me, there are a lot of manufactured conflict moments in this movie to make it seem like, oh, you know, well, it wasn't that easy. It wasn't like everything was pulled off with a hitch, but yeah, but why did you bring Matt Damon along on this thing that you never intended to put him on? Let's see. Oh yeah. Honestly, aside from being in the security room when the cameras get hacked and then feigning a heart attack, I'm not sure if we even need Saul in this. And I love Carl Reiner, but it seems like the whole reason he's here is so, you know, like, it seems like the movie's telling you his case of jewels needs to get down in that vault. But like, it feels, once Yen gets out of that money thing and pulls out the case, he just puts those things in his pockets anyway. So I don't know why they couldn't have just put those things in his pockets in the first place. That may have been the alternative thing that they needed to do if Saul didn't get his case down there. But other than his heart attack, I don't know if he's really needed. That whole thing is even needed. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I think I see what you're saying. And there certainly is an alternate, it seems like there may be an alternate way to do it. He is used as a decoy a couple of times so that Clooney can get time with Julia Roberts, or Danny can get time with Tess. So it may just be that it's helpful to have a persona in the casino that can, you know, do those kind of things. And he is he's the actor of the group, right? Mm-hmm. Like, his job is to actually become somebody else. And he has to get himself. It serves two purposes. It gets the briefcase into the vault, and then also gets somebody into the security room to watch the briefcase in the vault and to create a distraction while they switch the tapes.
Yeah, so. It's really basically the only thing like that it comes down to, is that he needs to be in that security room. I don't know how they know he will be in there once they start delivering the case. But yeah, I'm not saying he's worthless. I just think it's funny that they go through all this trouble. I need to put this case down here. And then Yen just sticks all those things in his pockets at the end anyway. They didn't really need to go through all that, but they did, just for the idea of him being in the room and feigning that heart attack when the cameras go off and everything. So not completely worthless. I just wish that could have been rounded out a little bit better on their plan. But and then let's see. Yes. And then, yeah, we talked about the flyers and then I think also at the very end of this movie, they are kind of asleep at the wheel when they go to get Danny at the prison. I mean, certainly, you know, Benedict is looking for you and like is kind of suspicious of you. Don't put Tess in the back of the car when you go and pick him up and everything. Make that a surprise somewhere else. Of course, this has, you know, ramifications into Ocean's 12 later, which I think they have to like all of them have to give all that money back and everything. And then sets that one in motion, even though that one ends up being an art heist by the end of it. But yeah, they kind of fall asleep at the wheel in there. Anyway, I'm enough negative about the movie. I do really enjoy this. I think this is one of those type of things where it was good that they got these guys when they did. George Clooney, Brad Pitt, Matt Damon, all these guys, Julia Roberts, getting all these stars all on one movie must have been a headache. I mean, even though it's Soderbergh and he was red hot at the time, I feel like getting all those schedules cleared out to do this. And this one of the last movies that probably one of the last movies of the movie star era that you could talk about too. Like the movie star is fading at this point. And there's only a handful now that I think can just like sell a movie on their name alone. And some of these guys, even Clooney had a rough time selling movies just on his name alone. And that's not anything new for a lot of these guys, but there's something about the sort of the transition point here that they make this movie in 2001 and movie stars are kind of fading out in the distance. This is one of the last movies you're going to see like this, where you're going to be excited about how many big stars they got into it, because there's not that many anymore.
Yeah. You covered so many of the things that I love about this movie and so many of the little nitpicks I would have. I will say that this is one of those movies that I just don't care. I'm having so much fun that even when those little things, you know, pop up in my head, I just like, you know, make the movie, have fun. I'm having so much fun with this crew and everything that they're doing. I even think of things like every one of these, the pieces are going to get put together, and every one of these people is in trouble. Like, especially the Malloy brothers, they are, it'll be so clear that they've been in the building three or four different times, you know, as three or four different parts of this scheme. They can't show their faces anywhere. And the movie never, it almost makes it feel like they all get off scot-free. And I'm just like, so many of them are clearly caught on camera being a part of this thing. So it's just the movie never really wants to reckon with that. I there's so many lines in this movie, and I'm not going to just do a list of quotes. You mentioned some. I there are two I want to bring out. One is when Brad and George are talking about, sorry, I always go with actor names, when Danny and Rusty are talking about somebody that they wanted on the team who had died. He says, "Send flowers." And then Rusty says, "Dated his wife for a while." And it's so subtle, like as if that is equivalent. Like that's Rusty's version of sending flowers is, you know, I treated his wife real nice for a while. We had a good time. Mm-hmm. Just cracked me up. And then again, all the Tess and Danny stuff is great, but my favorite one, maybe not my favorite, one of my favorite ones is Danny says, "Now they tell me I paid my debt to society." And Tess says, "Funny, I never got a check." That kills me every single time.
Oh, yeah.
In so many of these lines, there's a real subtlety to the delivery, a real smoothness. It's, you know, it's just so much fun to listen to and watch. There's also a subtlety into some of the things it's doing. Before we even get to Danny meeting up with Tess for the first time in the restaurant, you know, and having that meeting, we get this subtle moment with Benedict, with Terry and Tess, where she goes in to give him a kiss and he looks up at the camera as if to indicate, don't kiss me right now. There's a camera here. So, you know, somebody's watching, which again pays off later with her big line at the end. You know, you should know there's always somebody watching. But even more than that, it sets the audience up to know we don't like this. Like, this guy is, you know, so much more concerned about appearances than their relationship. And it gives us just enough to root against that relationship to, you know, want her to be with the career criminal. It really sets us up to root for Tess and Danny in a really real way, which I love. You're right about the reason for Matt Damon being there is really just kind of this Rube Goldberg foreshadowing kind of thing where, you know, him being there results in Yen's hand getting hurt. Yen's hand getting hurt results in, you know, stuff being on his hand when he's pulling, you know, setting things up, which results in him getting stuck, like, you know.
Yeah.
And so there's what I love about that, though, this very subtle thing that I love about that is that when Yen is trapped and they realize the batteries are out in the trigger, Matt Damon says to George Clooney, he says, yeah, you got to be careful. You have to be on your game at all times. You never know when something's going to, you know, impact things or whatever. Well, he's talking about, I mean, he is the one that made Yen be caught through his, like, I think that's really clever. It's almost so subtle that I kind of wonder if it was even intentional, but it's like, it's clearly there. And, and so, yeah, that's always fun for me too. There's so much in this movie that I love.
And by the way, someone in the chat came up a question that I had as well about the Terry not wanting to kiss Tess with the cameras looking. If they're dating, what does it matter? If any, like, everybody knows that they're dating. So I didn't understand why he was so, unless it was because he would look unprofessional to everybody and not in control.
I think that's
the only thing that I can think of. But at the same time, everybody knows that you're dating. A little kiss here isn't going to, like, you know, ruin your reputation. Everybody knows not to mess with you. But at the same time, yeah, it's probably just a professional type of thing in the end. That's what it comes down to. I also watched, go ahead.
What were you gonna say? I was just gonna say that, you know, I forgive so much of this movie. A lot of the nitpicks, like your biggest one with the flyers, I didn't even notice there were flyers in the vault. I thought it was just money. I didn't even remember seeing flyers in the vault. So I guess, you know,
well, not to mention the ones that come up in the elevator in the back. So they have to carry those out. There's in the instructions, because the bags come out to the van. And then the van goes off on its automated journey, and then it blows up, and that's where they find out there's flyers there. There's flyers in the vault, too, so to make it look like they've just blown up a bunch of flyers, basically. So when they come up in the elevator, that means they had to have the flyers there for the bags, too. So there's countless amounts of flyers in this that they've smuggled down into the vault somehow. That
I guess I just assumed they came with you know, earlier or something, and just, you know, had them in the,
yeah, they didn't, because the only person that gets down in the vault during the entire thing until Clooney and Damon do is Yen. So nobody brings them down at that point, and then the SWAT team comes in after the bags have been taken to the van. So nobody on the SWAT team just happens to take in any flyers either. So it's just one of those things where
who takes the bags to the van? Is it the Ocean's crew?
No, it's their actual crew. It's the actual Bellagio security guards that take those bags.
Next time I'll have to pay better attention. Well, how did the Bellagio, I'm confused. How did the Bellagio team get those? So it's saying the Bellagio team went down to the vault,
prepackaged
bags. Okay.
They went to the elevator. They put the bags on the elevator and sent the bags up to the elevator. Then the security guards took them off. And yeah.
All right.
Anyway, I know we're running out of time. I did watch the original Ocean's 11 with Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin. To sort of compare these two movies and everything, this 2001 version blows this one out of the water, the 1960 version. The 1960 version, much like a lot of movies, I mean, you could even put It's a Mad, 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 Mad World in this. When it gets a bunch of stars, it's like, okay, we need to give time to these stars and do what they do and blah, blah, blah. And like Dean Martin, who had just come out with a song called Ain't That a Kick in the Head, sings that song four times in the movie. Like, it's just one of those, like, let's get in there and let's let Dean Martin do his songs. And the movie wastes so much time. You don't even know what they're going to do. And for like an hour of the movie, you know that they're up to something. They're all a part of the 82nd Airborne. They all used to be in the same, they were all in the war together and all that. That's the way they know each other. And the heist is five casinos in 1960, and they, it's very basic. It's turning off the power, basically kind of like what they do in this one, but it's a different, they just knock a tower down and the power goes out for a while, and they go in through some doors that are marked, and they get that have that glow in the dark paint or whatever. And they just walk out with the money while it's dark. And that's basically what it comes down to. And that movie, yeah, movie just wastes so much time. I'm just like, this is okay. I kind of like this. I mean, it's okay. It's all right. It's just not, it's nothing special about it whatsoever. It might've been special back in 1960, but
yeah,
the, super secret double feature on this one.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret. What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Chat has come up with a lot of good ones, but I am going to go with Inception on this one. This is the things that this movie reminds me of that one so much is that it's about getting the crew, and it's not necessarily all people you know intimately, but like just know that they're good at a certain thing. And of course, the main the story about Inception was that this is like shooting a movie, and like everybody's got their own roles, you know, one's a producer, one's a writer, one's an actor, blah blah blah, all the stuff. And he also has a thing where an ex-wife could compromise the whole mission, which is something that happens in Inception as well. Mm-hmm. As well as Ocean's 11. So I think these two movies have a lot in common, as far as that, you know, setting up a heist and the characters involved in it. There are plenty of good ones that are mentioned in the chat. Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, I think, is one of my favorite ones, but just because of all the things that just keep going back and forth in that movie. But they, you know, there's a lot of good ones, like Italian Job. People mention Out of Sight, which is a poster that's behind my head right now. Those are all very good, but I thought Inception would be the one for me on this one, just the assembling of the crew and all the different little aspects that I think are about the same. So
I like it.
All right. For next week, the movie that I'm going to go for here, since we talk about this movie a lot in, you know, just movie vocabulary and everything, it would be good to revisit it, especially under this format. And I'm going to do Rashomon from 1950. Akira Kurosawa's, you know, masterpiece. So a very short movie. I believe it's on Max and it's on Criterion Channel. I don't know where else it might be, but I'm looking forward to rewatching this movie. This is a really good one. Have you seen this one, Dicer?
I have not seen Rashomon. I am excited for this. It's been on my list of shame for a while, and I'm excited to tick it off.
All right. Awesome. If someone's asking if we've done this before, I have looked and made sure that it wasn't done while I was away. And I'm pretty sure we didn't do it when I was here before that. I think it may have been small recommended. It's definitely been referenced, especially a month or so ago when we were talking about The Last Duel, which has a lot of similarities to this one. Anyway. I'm looking forward to going to this. It's an hour and a half. You would think, you know, a movie with this stature is going to be one of those epic 3-hour long things. It's not. It's an hour and a half. So anyway, that's going to do it for this week. And you're maybe still in Vegas next week at this time?
Yeah, I'll still be hanging out here for the show next week. Yep.
Okay. All right. All right. That's going to do it for this week. Once again, thank you, chat, for coming out and watching us talk about movies. Appreciate that. We will see you next time. See ya.
See you guys.
Bye. Part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
I got a new microphone to travel with.
All right. It looks colorful and exciting.
It is. It like changes colors.
Yeah.
And I can turn that off. But since I'm in Vegas, I thought, you know, when in Vegas, do as the Vegans do.
Exactly. So are you going to be doing some WSOP while you're out there?
Yeah. Yeah, there's an opening freeze out that I'm really excited about. $500 freeze out.
That's like event three, yeah. Something like that. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, it'll be my first freeze out, which I'm excited for because I never rebuy. Mm-hmm. So like it's always annoying when people are just playing crazy.
Yes.
And take you out. Like I had my aces cracked by ace six because of this. The guy was just like, it's time to, you know, like he literally said after he got it all in, you know, I'm just, you know, here's my rebuy or whatever.
Oh yeah.
And then of course he, you know, pulls the straight on the river or whatever, but, but it's like a freeze out will be nice. Cause everybody's on the same page. Like this is it. We all get one bullet and we all have to use it wisely. So
I don't think it's any surprise that the ones that I've gotten far in are ones that are freeze outs, and they're both turbo structures, and so like those were the ones that I got, like, you know, one was I think 19th and another one was 38th last year, and those were the ones where you could just kind of be like, you know, I got a hand, let's go with it, and not worry about it. But also there weren't constantly people who got knocked out who were coming back in to just flood the whole thing back up and everything. So yeah, I prefer the freeze out myself.
And then I'm gonna play over the weekend. I'm gonna play in the Mystery Millions again, which I thought was really, really fun.
Is that the Mystery Bounty and all that?
Yeah. So you can make the money on day one, but there are no bounties until day two. Mm-hmm. So like around dinner or so, you'll hit the money. But then if you make it to the next day, then it really gets interesting because every bounty you win could be worth $1 million. And it's kind of fun how they set it up. They have this big treasure chest that like has all these envelopes in it for the bigger prizes. I think the 25K bounties and up. Mm-hmm. And so if somebody... Like, it's just a list of people who have knocked people out, and it'll just say $1,000, $5,000, $2,000, $1,000. It'll just go through the list, and then it'll get to a name, and it'll be like, you know, sirens go off. And it's like that person has to come up, pull the envelope out of the case, and then, you know, sweat opening the envelope and see if they won, you know, $1,500,000, $250,000, $100,000, $50,000, or
$25,000. Yeah.
So...
What's the lowest ones?
1,000. Every bounty's worth at least, it may be 2,000. I can't remember. It seemed like it was 1,000 was the lowest bounty. So, you know, you knock somebody out on day two, you're guaranteed $1,000.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, bounties are awesome. I like bounties quite a bit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anything that adds a little variance is fun, you know?
Yeah.
It makes it fun.
Because that was what that turbo was last year that I went deep in was a bounty structure. So I got seven of those, and those were 500. Nice. Those were 500 each. But the but that really just, you know, it's like boom. Just I bought for the price of getting into the tournament, like in the first 2 hours, I think, or something like that. Something like that.
Yeah,
it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, we actually rented a car this time, so we may like go out to like drive over to the Grand Canyon. Like, it's a couple hours to the west edge of the Grand Canyon. So, you know, or Hoover Dam's nearby, or what's the big Red Rock? Is that go see Red Rock. So there's some stuff that we might.
Red Rock is a place where I feel like I nearly died one day. I'm really? Serious. I'm dead serious. Like, I was as close as, like, you. There is some hyperbole here, but it was one of the hottest days. Somebody had told me, if you ever go there, go in the morning, go like early in the morning, like 4 or 5 or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't going to do that. I made sure that I brought a lot of water, though. A lot of water. And so I was good for the first leg of the trip, which got me to the view of Vegas, where you get to this one part. And then on the way back, I still had some water, but it was kind of like getting into that red area where I had to kind of like make sure that I wasn't like downing it completely. And it was, I mean, yeah, we're talking about 110 probably degrees outside. And like, once I got back to my car, I was not thinking straight and was just complete, like almost completely like delirious. I had to sit there for a while and make sure I had still had some water left at the end of it. There was one bottle that I had that was, that for whatever reason, I had stuck it in a part of the refrigerator that where it froze, and that frozen water stayed frozen. That's how frozen it was all the way through this trip. And so it was the last bottle I had. And so I was like, on the way back, I was using that as my, my like recovery water and everything. But yeah, Red Rock is worth it. Be sure to bring water and bring, you know, shoes that you can, you know, walk around in and all sorts of stuff. But yeah, Grand Canyon is definitely worth it if you've never been there before. I've been now twice. And the drive out there is just unbelievable. It's such a great, I mean, depending on where you go, it doesn't really matter which way you go. You're going to see some awesome desert landscapes. It doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. But, last year went to the Northern Rim, which takes you through Utah. And it's just one of those things where you're on a road and you just can't believe like the panorama that you're driving through at that moment. Yeah. It just doesn't seem real. I know that there's people out there who drive it every day and it's like, you know, that's Utah for you. But for me, it was, you know, I'd never seen anything like it before.
Yeah, that was Alaska. Alaska was like that. You just get on the road and start in just the most gorgeous mountains, 360. Mm-hmm. Just like everywhere you look is like a picture you could take. Yeah. It's that's fun. Nature's cool.
Oh, yeah.
Nature is cool. Yeah, we're getting excited. We're going to go see all of the UK. So we're doing like 4 or 5 days in Ireland in October. Mm-hmm. I'm really excited for some of like the beach mount, you know, rocky beach kind of stuff, because we don't really have that here in the States. Like there's some like Northeast beaches that have rocks on them, but there's nothing like cliffs right out to the ocean kind of stuff. So. Yeah, that'll be cool.
Is Ian going to be in on that?
Yes, he's going to be our tour guide for like London, and we'll probably stay a couple days at his place. But yeah, I'm also doing like all this research into the like genealogy of our family and stuff, because we are like both sides, my mom's side and my dad's side are UK, like that's where they came from. Mm-hmm. My dad's side came through Canada first, then to Michigan, and they left in like the early 1800s. And my mom's side, like, are OG colonizers. Like they were here in the 1600s, like before the Mayflower came over. Like they were in Virginia and doing that stuff. So
were they dicers?
My mom's side were birds. Mm-hmm. And like, if you look up like, BYRD, by the way, if you look up like Colonel, was it William Byrd or something like that? Mm-hmm. Like very famous Virginian, was, I think, governor of, I think founded the city of Richmond.
I think that's what I remember. I think hearing that name from. Yes.
Yeah. But anyway, so that's like my mom's great, great, great grandpa. But my dad's side, there were dicers in England. So like Somerset area is where they lived up until the mid 1800s. And so I'm doing like all this research on like, is there a gravestone I could go see, you know, the, from like one of my ancestors, one of my dicer ancestors or whatever. And that we found three graves, confirmed dicer graves in the Somerset area. However, because it was like early 1800s, they didn't have stones or any kind of memorials or anything. Like they're just buried there. So now I'm trying to decide, you know, is it worth the trip down to just like walk in the cemetery where other dicers are buried just for like kind of the historical aspect of it? You know, I guess the question I'm asking in this modern era is it worth anything without a picture? Is really what it comes down to.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.